Brigadier General Robinson Reisner. I think it's a name that's familiar to all of you. General Reisner enlisted in the U.S. Army Air Corps back in April of 1943. He was awarded his pilot wings, commissioned as second lieutenant May of 44. He flew more than 100 combat missions in F-86s against the MiG-15s over North Korea. He's credited with 8 enemy aircraft destroyed, became the 20th jet ace during the Korean War. In the 1950s, General Reisner was selected to fly the Charles Lindbergh commemoration flight from New York to Paris. Flying the F-100, he set a transatlantic speed record, covering the distance in 6 hours and 38 minutes. You perhaps know the name better for what took place during the Vietnam War. He was shot down over North Vietnam in April of 65, rescued, then in September of the same year was shot down again and captured, held prisoner in Hanoi for 7 years as the senior ranking officer during that time. You may be aware of his book, The Passing of the Night. His military decorations and awards include the Air Force Cross with 1 oak leaf cluster, Distinguished Flying Cross with 2 oak leaf clusters, Bronze Star Medal with V device and 1 oak leaf cluster, Air Medal with 7 oak leaf clusters, Joint Service Commendation Medal, Purple Heart with 3 oak leaf clusters, Presidential Unit Citation Emblem, Air Force Outstanding Unit Award Ribbon with 2 combat V devices, Republic of Korea Presidential Unit Citation Ribbon, and the Republic of Vietnam Gallantry Cross with V device. It's a very distinguished gentleman that I present to you, one who has suffered much for his country and his God, and I'm distinctly honored to present to you General Reisner.
How do you like my timing? I arrived just in time. We're almost late. You know, I didn't even know that this was a Christian college until we turned the corner. That's how my time has been late. I just feel so much better knowing where I am now. I thought I was coming to talk to a secular college, and I had a few facts that I wanted to pass along, and I had in mind that I must say before I got up to talk, or as I talked, I was going to say, folks, I'm sorry to tell you, but you don't get equal time. You see, I've spoken on some campuses where we've had a certain few students that make a profession of dissidents, and they always insist on getting equal time to speak. And I'm glad that I don't have to say that this morning. I'm glad that I'm talking to who I am, and I want to share with you just a few minutes. You didn't tell me how long I'm to speak.
10 after the hour.
Okay. Gives me 2 hours and 50. The reason I'm here, I suspect, is that I have a story in some ways unique. Let's say it's different than most, simply because most people don't spend 7 years and 4 months in a communist prison. And then, out of all those, there are some who don't know God. I've known God for many, many years. And this will kind of set the stage. I received Christ as my Savior when I was a young boy. And so I've kind of been on talking terms with the Lord for a long time. So when I was shot down the second time, well, let me tell you, for just prepare you for what I'm going to say. For many years, while I was growing up, and I was a member of a Christ Ambassadors group, I grew up with a group of Christians. And that was my whole life. I went to prayer meeting. I went to outstation work. I went horseback riding, canoeing, motorcycling, and so forth, all with the same group of people, because those are the people that I related to. They talked my language. I didn't have to worry about smutty stories and dirty jokes and so forth. I was at home with this group of people, and those are the people I grew up with. But I had fun. I've got scars to prove it all over. I had a lot of fun. Motorcycles, I used to ride Bronx and rodeo, and I even was accused of driving fast cars, and so, I hope I relate to you. I have 5 sons, and the oldest is 21. So, I know that a lot of what I'm going to say is not going to impress you, you know, because it doesn't impress them either. Perhaps you will be impressed, though, to know that there's no place that I have been. Supersonic, I've been pretty high in test flights and so forth. I've had accidents in the air. I've had my heart torn so badly you could hear it with your bare ear, and God healed me. I've had accidents in combat so that I was blinded and couldn't see and was talked home by a junior, as we call him, a junior birdman, by a lieutenant who shouldn't have been that good, but was. This was before I went to combat in Vietnam. And I've had God with me all this time. So I'm not talking about someone with whom I'm just recently on familiar terms. But in Vietnam, when I was shot down the second time, the first time I recovered to sea about a half a mile, and I had a lot of airplanes shooting down gunboats, North Vietnam gunboats, to keep them off of me until I was rescued. The second time, no such luck. I was flying just about as high above the ground as I'm standing above the floor, and my theory on this particular flight was they had just recently brought in a bunch of surface-to-air missiles, and they were getting pretty hard to handle because anything above 1,000 feet were fair game, and they were knocking some of our ships down. So we were after these. We had five surface-to-air missile sites we were going after. We had two-man teams, two airplanes in each team. The first one was carrying a load of napalm. He was to burn the control center. The other guy had eight 750-pound bombs. He was to pop up into afterburner and come in and dive bomb it and destroy the missiles. Well, we had five such teams. We went out more or less in line abreast, about 15 miles apart, looking for these particular sites. On this particular mission, I'd been hit a lot of times previously, and I said, this time I'm going to fly so low and so fast, and they're not even going to see me until I'm gone. So I was running about 600 miles an hour, and I was flying just about this high. It didn't work. Somebody got the word. I had my target was 10 miles north of the provincial capital of Than Hoa, right up Highway Route 1, which was 3 miles inland. And this is in North Vietnam, about 90 miles south of the capital of Hanoi. As I come into my turn point, made a turn, and leveled out, again, I let down and was very low. And then there was a little hill, and it was just about, it wasn't quite as tall as this building that I had to go over. And when I pulled up to go over it, they were already shooting. I don't know how they got the word, but as I raised up, now tracers, for you that don't understand, tracers are bullets that burn in the air and leave a glow so that you can actually see them. Gunners, in other words, can see the tracer. For every tracer, there are 9 other rounds of ammunition that you can't see. So what they do is they use this tracer round to say, that's where my bullets are going, and I'm not leading this plane enough, and so forth. I was getting a lot of tracers when I came up, just raised my eye over the hill, and they ran some of them right down my engine intakes. The engine disintegrated. I had smoke and fire in the cockpit. And I said, I'm hit. I wasn't hit personally, but that's all I had time to say. My plane was hit. It reminded me, I don't know that I've ever described it, except I wrote a poem once when I was in prison, which I've never really told anybody about. But it was like I was riding a big, you see, I used to ride a lot of horses. I still have some. But I was riding a big, strong horse. I was flying an F-105. It was massive and heavy and sleek and would really carry the mail. I had all these napalm tanks hung on there. And that booger was just, you could just feel it champing at the bit, you know? And I got the impression I was riding some big war horse. And when these bullets hit it, you know, it's just like somebody had shot it with in a vital part. The airplane shuddered like this. And then it gasped. The engine just gasped because it had ingested all this ammunition. It was just like I was riding an animal. And I felt it gasp. And I went to afterburner. That's like laying the whip to a steed. The afterburner gives you 50% more power immediately by dumping raw fuel into the engine. When I went afterburner, this is an instinctive motion. Anytime you get in trouble, you give it all the power you got. And if it's bad trouble, you hit what we call the panic button. It's a little red button that says, jettison all. Well, the pilots say that's your panic button. When you really get scared, you just hit that. What happens is that all your pylons carried on the bottom of the airplane, on which are hung bombs and tanks and anything you want to carry, rockets, missiles, when you press this button, there are some explosive charges in every one of the pylons, and they all go. It cleans the bottom of the airplane completely off, and you got a nice, clean airplane. Really, it's like you've stripped for action. Well, this is all instinctive. Go to afterburner, hit the panic button, the airplane kind of leaps because you've just unloaded several thousand pounds. The afterburner caught. I couldn't see anything because smoke and fire had filled the cockpit. I couldn't see my instruments, and I was getting pretty hot. My leg was burning. I pulled on the stick and headed towards the water. It was 3 miles to my right. As I started up, the engine quit, and about 1 second later, the stick came right back in my lap, indicating the controls had burned through and the ship pitched. Now, I couldn't see, so I didn't know if it pitched this way, or what, but it pinned me against the top, and my shoulder straps were tight. So I had to get up, and I didn't know how high I was, so I reached around. On each side of you have part of your armrest terminates in a handle. Either handle pulled will jettison your canopy. It blows it off with an explosive charge. It has a kind of a runner or a track and steel across. In other words, it doesn't just blow a hole in it. It just gets rid of the whole shooting match. And then you have a trigger on either handle. Once you've pulled it up, you can press either trigger. If one of your arms are broken or incapacitated, the other one will work. When you press the trigger, then it jettisons your seat. The seat is armed with a 37 millimeter cannon shell. It really boots you. So, I pulled the trigger, and out I went. Everything happens automatically after that. Then you have another little small charge. Luckily, it's not too great, or you'd have a big hole in your stomach. It blows your belt apart. You see, you've got your seat belt and your shoulder straps, and it's all hooked. So you don't have to mess with all this. It's on a timing thing. A particle of a second after your seat goes, this thing blows apart, and then you've got a canvas strap that you're sitting on. There's a roller in front, and this roller goes zip, and it straightens this canvas, and it just boots you right out of the seat. You see, so it separates you from the seat, all automatic. Then your parachute has a solenoid in, a barometric solenoid. Anytime you're below 14,000 feet, this parachute will open immediately. So you see, everything happens automatically, even if you're unconscious, and this is what happened. I was not unconscious, but everything happened automatically. The chute opened with a big shock because I was going quite fast. I looked up to check to see if my chute was open, and I hadn't lost any of the panels from the speed. And when I looked down, my plane had already hit the ground and was burning. So I was very close to the ground. Now, this brings me back, I guess, to really why I'm here. Is my chute open? And I looked up and saw my chute was okay. I said, thank you, Lord. Not for the fact that I've got a chute. Not for the fact. And I looked down, there were people running from everywhere. Military and civilians, all converging on the spot. They thought I was going to hit the ground. I knew it was going to be a long war, and I knew also this was an answer to prayer. I started to tell you a while ago, while I was growing up, when I was a teenager, and when I graduated from high school and I was seeking what I should do, I, myself and all the group of my fellow Christian young people, my counselors, were all praying with me, what is to be my destiny? What should I do? I had a brother already in Bible school, and my friends were going to Bible school, a lot of them. But I didn't feel this was for me. And so we prayed. Well, I'd had a big burden. Every once in a while it would get so great, I would break down and cry. Now, I'm not emotional normally, but I couldn't understand this. And then years later, it finally was impressed upon me. God just wanted me to turn my life over to Him. Now, I was living a Christian life, but I wasn't giving myself to God. I wasn't saying, I'll go where you want me to go and I'll do what you want me to do. I couldn't do that. I loved to ride the motorcycles. I loved to fly fighters. And all these wonderful things I was doing, traveling around the world with all these jumping up and down guys that I flew with and their wives and their girlfriends. This was a wonderful, exciting life, and I didn't want to take a chance on sacrificing any part of it. And so I simply said to God, after much prayer, years of prayer, I finally came to the place I said, Lord, I know I'm not giving you all of my life. And I really want to, but I don't have the guts. I was at least honest. I said, I like what I'm doing too much, but I want you to have me. So if you really want me, and I said this, if you really want me, take me. Hey, don't flirt with God. Don't sincerely ask God to do something unless you're ready for action. Now, this has been impressed upon me many times. I had visions after that I would lose my eyesight, my ears, one of my arms or my legs, because I knew God needed to slow me down. I had to stop flying or do something differently so He could gain possession of my life. Well, none of that happened. When the chute opened, though, I said, aha, this is it. This is the answer to prayer. I said, thank you, Lord. And I looked for a long war, but but not nearly so long as it was. And so that's how I came to be in prison. That's why I'm here today. After 2 years in prison, it took me 2 long years of sincere prayer of like 14, 15, 16 hours a day. And I prayed all day. I prayed while I was doing exercises. I exercised 12 or 14 hours a day. I got where I couldn't even get tired. I could run 5 hours. I could run 10 miles, 50. One day I ran 25. Now, how did I run 25? I just counted my steps. And you count so many steps for a mile. And I raised my knees up good and high so that it was straining. What I'm saying is my body finally got so accustomed, I could do hundreds of push-ups. I could do 75 push-ups on my fingertips. I could do 90 on the flat of my hands. I could do sit-ups until the hide would wear off my tailbone. You know, it was no effort. That's all I did. I exercised and prayed all day long. There was nothing. No books, no papers, no friends, nobody to talk to. I was in solitary confinement for over 4 years. I was in isolation from all other prisoners for 2. So, during this period of time, I said, now's the time I'm going to really set things straight until I can say, okay, Lord, here I am. You can have me. Took 2 years before, you know, not all of you are that hard-headed, I hope. But it took me 2 years before I could finally come to the place where I could sincerely say and mean what I said and knew that I could make it come true when I said, I'll go where you want me to go. I'll do anything. And I remember as I prayed that, that time when I knew I could come to the point where I had come to the point where I could mean it, I was crying. And I remember saying to the Lord, so that he would know that I was sincere. I said, Lord, I don't care what you want me to do. Even if it's digging ditches for a living. I said, I'll dig the deepest, straightest, longest ditch you've ever seen. And I'm in it. Well, that's what I'm here today for. Recently, and I've been flying fighter for 33 years. And I've served on my portion of staffs. I was recently at Nellis Air Force Base, the vice commander of the Weapons Center. It's a large establishment. We have 3 million acres of ground. We have a lot of tremendous, exciting things going on there. And I love the Air Force so much that when I came back to Clark Air Force Base in the morning after we were freed, and I was in my room and they brought my blue uniform in and started to fit me, I had missed it so much that I just broke down and cried to think that I was coming back home and I was going to be in my uniform again. I love those people, those wonderful people that serve us in the military service. They're dedicated and talented and loyal and knowledgeable. They're the greatest organization in the world. And so I had no reason to leave it. I could still serve till 1984. And with a little luck, I might progress a couple of more times. But a few months ago, God started making a change in my life. I didn't even know what it was all about. I just knew it was something was happening, and I told a few friends. I don't know what's happening, but God's stirring with a big stick all around me. And so things just happened until finally I felt it was time to get out. And so I retired from the service in July. And I'm speaking. That's all I'm doing right now. I'm doing a few other things. I've even had time to play 3 games of golf in about the last 4 months. It's not the retirement I thought it was going to be. But as long as I'm walking where God wants me to walk, well, that's all I care about. Let me tell you what time. Oh, I got to watch that clock. That clock's not running. I'm really observant this morning, aren't I? You all might have been here till this afternoon. 10 after 10. You know, I thought I would talk a minute and then answer a few questions. I didn't ask permission, but I'm sure that he wouldn't tell me no right up here on the stage, would he? Let me just tell you one event. God did some wonderful things for me, as well as many others while I was in prison. But he answered some prayers at my specific request. He answered prayers in a way so that I could have proved to me that there was a living God. You see, even after all I've told you, after living a Christian life, after seeing miracles of healing in my own body, my mother, my brothers and sisters' bodies, seeing a little girl's leg extended 9 inches, all those wonderful things, still, when the chips were really down, I was in pain, I was lonely, I was in despair. All these things, the thought came through my mind, what if there isn't a God? Have you ever seen him? You know, military men are very objective normally, and we don't deal much in fairy tales or fantasies. And so I guess it was not natural for this old logical mind to say, hey, have you ever seen God? You know, that's the person that's keeping you alive, but have you ever seen him? That's where you're getting all your hope and faith for the future. That's the only person you have to talk to. That's the only person you have to give you healing, because there are no medicine. And then the thoughts came to me, well, what if there is one? You see, it would have been easier, much easier to die than it was to live. Living was a chore every day. Sometimes you screamed in pain for hours before they released you. They pulled our shoulders out of joint sometimes and split my ribs. There was torture, and there was harassment, and there was degradation and humiliation the whole time. They tried to use this for propaganda. What I'm saying, it wasn't an easy life. I wouldn't live it again for all the money every minute. If I knew that 7 years and 4 months from now, I could get out with all the money in the whole world, if I owned the whole world, it wouldn't be worth it. That's how bad it was. There was only one reason that I would do it again, and that was for the same reason I did it in the first time. Because I believe so devoutly in what America stands for. I believe so strongly that it was our responsibility to protect the rights of those who could not protect their rights. Their rights of freedom of choice. And I still believe that we made the right move. We didn't follow up on it right. I'm terribly sorry about what happened. And I'm sorry for the traumatic aftermath of Vietnam that seems to still be affecting America, so that we can't seem to get a hold of the resolve that we need to continue to make America a credible force that stands between marching, militant communism and the free world. And we're simply going down the tubes. We have been surpassed by Russia in the recent years. They now have more nuclear submarines. They now have more more submarine-launched ballistic missiles. They have more intercontinental ballistic missiles. Their warheads, their missiles will carry three times the warheads as ours. They have more ships on the sea. We have gone from 2,900 tactical airplanes ahead till we're 350 behind. They have more than 2-to-1 men under arms than we do. They train some 25 million a year under arms. What I'm saying is that we've been surpassed. We don't have rough equivalency. If anyone wants to use that term anymore, that's either an error in judgment or they're attempting to mislead us. We are no longer number one power in the world. And I'm very concerned. Well, I didn't come here to tell you that. I just want to share with you. God answered prayer so that I know that there is a living God. He did it in such a way that nobody could duplicate it. And no one even knew that I prayed it. Except me and God. So that, now that I'm preaching to the choir, and I know that. You all know there's a living God. But I'm so happy to be able to stand here and say that God is just as real as the scientific law of gravity to me. It's a knowledge, not a belief. It's not a faith. It's a sure knowledge that there really is a living God that controls my destiny as long as I let him and can control yours. One time when they moved me back to a cell, put me in stocks, and I'm going to have to capsulize this. They put me in stocks. It was a terrible ordeal because I'd always been very active. I've never been tied down except when I was sick, very sick. Now I couldn't move. I was sleeping on cement. And above my head, and about 14 feet above the floor, just outside my window, and they had a small opening in my window where the noise could come in and some light and some air. There was a speaker. It was a slave speaker hooked to a radio, and it covered about a two-block area. It was for the benefit of all the Vietnamese within hearing. It was their radio that propaganda came out of all day long. They got the news and the results of the different battles. All their songs, all their plays, all their news media was devoted to thought-controlling the population. This was terribly loud, and there was no opening in my cell except right there. And I was like I was on the inside of a guitar or something. And besides that, I couldn't move. And I really suffered, and I thought, they're using this to torture me. And it really was a hideous torture. The noise and the one-string instrument all day, you know, their traditional music is quite different than ours. My apologies to any Vietnamese friends that happen to be here. So by the second day, I was a quivering mass. My nerves were just raw. But the morning of the third day, I said, I can't hack it any longer. And I couldn't. I'd had all I could hack. I was ready to start screaming and crying. They'd reduced me to that simply by putting me in stocks and that speaker. So I simply said, Lord, you know I've had all I can take. I'm asking you to take that speaker off the air. When I said that, the speaker stopped. The There was no more noise. Some soldiers came down that lived above me. I was in isolation away from the other American prisoners. Soldiers living over me came down and plopped the ladder against the wall. I could hear them. And they climbed up and began to shake this old speaker and beat on it to make it work. And all they got was static. And for 32 days, that speaker that I was in stops, the speaker never came back on again. God did that numbers of times. I was in terrible agony one time. I'd been tortured bad because I had, as the Vietnamese said, I disgraced them in front of a foreign country. They had made me meet an East German film crew to make a documentary. It forced me by rope, using the ropes, the torture that pulls you apart. And I said, I can't do that. But they had forced me. And they'd even rehearsed my lines so that I would answer each question which the German film crew was going to ask. They had been supplied a list of questions. I, in turn, had been rehearsed on my answers. They were all lies. But I was to say such things as the war is illegal and immoral, and we must dismantle our bases in South Vietnam and withdraw all our troops. I was dying. I'd had kidney stones twice, had been incoherent for about a week, and now they came in and rushed in and got me all well, gave me bananas and cream and sugar, and I was so dumb, I didn't know what they were doing, I should have stayed sick. They got me well enough to get me down to the film crew, and then they started asking me these questions. I couldn't go through with it. And so they said I disgraced them. I wouldn't answer the questions the way I was supposed to answer. So then they said, we understand they had given me two pictures of my family that morning to make me more pliable. They had arrived in the mail and they'd been holding them. The pictures of my family also had a picture of Christ on the wall behind them. Those two pictures were the most sacred things I've ever possessed because it was my link, my connection with my family. I knew that every one of them had stood there for that picture. They all had handled that picture. And I could contact them through that. And there was a picture of Jesus Christ that I longed for so much. I wanted to touch a Bible worse than I wanted something to eat, and I was hungry. So the German film crew at the end said, we understand you have two pictures, and we'd like to use those, and we'll give them back to you. And I died inside to think their filthy hands was going to touch something so sacred. They made a mistake of returning me to my cell before they came after the pictures. By the time they arrived, I'd destroyed them and tore them into tiny pieces, put them with a rock, rolled them in a piece of paper, and sunk them in my refuse bucket. That was my toilet. When they came after me and found that I destroyed them, came after the pictures and found I destroyed them, they took me to the torture chamber. And they worked on me with ropes until I had screamed a long time. And then they let me loose and they said, okay, now where are the pictures? I still wouldn't tell them. So they worked on me again. The second time when I couldn't move, they had paralyzed me from the waist down. I said, they're in the waist bucket. I destroyed them. They drugged me in. They took them. I forced me to get in there and get them out. They washed them off, and there were the fragments. And I had, yes, I disgraced them in front of the Germans because they promised the Germans they could use them as part of the documentary. They never got to. So they were very angry. So they worked on me all night. They returned me to my cell. They put my legs in stocks. Now my legs were bloody and raw from the straps. My shoulders were cut. My arms were cut by the nylon straps they'd been using to torture me and the iron bar. So then they placed my legs in stocks. They twisted my arms behind me, put a terrible strain on it, and then they clicked the manacles in place, pressed them into the bone. I was there for 10 days and nights. I couldn't lay down because my arms were twisted in such a way I just couldn't lay down. 8 days after that, I was in such pain, and I had grown so fatigued. My mind was no longer working. I couldn't remember the names of my wife and children as I prayed. And I fell backward in fatigue. I closed the right manacle on my wrist one more notch, and I screamed in pain. And as I sat up, I said, Lord, I've had all I can take. I hadn't asked him to take me out. And the reason I hadn't is that I always felt I was in God's hand. I was where God wanted me. I didn't know why, but I didn't question him. I was learning. And I now know why. It was necessary. I was very intolerant. I was judgmental on all my fellow prisoners. I thought they weren't holding their end up. They were being too cooperative. They weren't being hard enough. I was to find out I wasn't nearly as strong as I should be. Well, all these things were necessary. But as I stood up and said, God, I've had all I can take, I ask you for help. The right edge of my bunk was sharp cement, and I looked over and saw it, and I just leaned over backwards, hooked my right manacle on it, and gave a jerk, and it came off. My right hand, my right arm was swollen, and was black, and had huge streaks. I could see the tendons moving my right wrist. where the flesh had exploded. The only way they could close the manacle on my right wrist was to press it through the flesh. And I was Justin. I had also been living in my own waste for days. They wouldn't free me. And somehow or other, I had failed to relieve myself for so long. I had a bladder block, and I was in terrible pain inside. And so when my handcuff came off, my legs were locked, a big old rusty padlock locking the end of the stocks. And I said, "Lord, one more lock." And with this part of my hand, I couldn't close my fingers. I just reached over and bumped it with my hand. The old big rusty padlock fell loose, and I lifted it off. And I got out of the stocks and relieved myself. Got back, locked my leg in, and then when the guard rattled the door, I managed to press the manacle back through the flesh and lock it in one place. But every time, now God answered prayers when I wasn't in terrible torture. But every time when the chips were down, I had to have help. God was right there, just like when he unlocked the doors for old Peter. That's the kind of God we serve. You have 7 minutes if you have a question. Yes.